we talk so much nowadays about this term biotech. It sounds to me like a bunch of bubbling beakers and faraway laboratories. What is the biotech industry? And probably more importantly than what is the view of life and especially the sanctity of life in the biotech industry today? Welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're broadcasting live, a rare live Friday broadcast of Issues Etc. This, the 11th of November, from the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis at the Westport Lakeside Chalet. We are right outside the conference room where a number of speakers are making presentations. And here in the first 25 minutes of the program, Dr. Nigel Cameron is our guest. We'll be talking with him about the sanctity of life in the biotech industry coming up in about 25 minutes on the program. Wesley Smith, a regular guest, will join us live here from the floor of the conference, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, to talk about bioethics and personhood. In the second hour of the program, two guests, Dr. David Prentice, will talk about national pro-life legislation. He's a senior fellow for life sciences at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C., and that's followed by a short conversation with Dr. Paul Robbie, who is also on a panel here, I believe, at the Image of God Bioethics Conference. We'll talk about the Image of God with Dr. Paul Robbie, chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Now, you can join us for all 3 hours of this live broadcast from the Image of God Bioethics Conference. Our call-in numbers, as usual, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live, and we know that's not ordinary. Usually you hear a best of issues, etc. Today it's live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference at the Westport Lakeside Chalet here in St. Louis. Our first guest to talk to us about the sanctity of life in the biotech industry is Dr. Nigel Cameron. He's president of the Institute on Biotechnology and the Human Future. He is director of the Council for Biotechnology Policy, and he delivered a keynote address at the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis titled The Sanctity of Life in the Biotech Industry. Dr. Cameron, welcome to Issues Etc.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
What do we mean when we use the term biotech? I picture kind of science fiction, scary stuff, things that shouldn't happen in laboratories. What is the biotech industry?
Well, I think you picture certainly part of the picture. I mean, a lot of what happens in biotechnology, of course, is basically very good. They're making drugs and all sorts of things that will help us here. But the industry also has the capacity to do things that certainly aren't good at all. And much of the anxiety of the last few years as we've looked at issues like cloning and stem cell research has been that the biotech industry as a group has decided to fight what many of us believe to be the obvious moral choices here and thoroughly politicize itself in the process. And that is not very encouraging as we face the future and the fact that they're going to be able to do in their companies and their labs and their universities, you know, far greater things than they've done so far.
Why fight what you consider to be kind of the obvious view of life and then the various ethical parameters that would come from a view that holds life to be sacred? Why has the industry chosen to take that direction?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I stopped by at their offices once 3 or 4 years ago and talked to Mike Werner, who was then their sort of chief lobbyist. I don't know whether he still is now. A nice fellow, and I sat down and talked to him about this, and I said, look, basically the biotech industry has greatly offended Europeans on the whole genetically modified food scenario, which is very unpopular in Europe. And now you're looking to offend the Americans on GM babies, you know, on cloning and embryo stem cell research and so on. I said, this isn't a very good business strategy, is it? That you really want to offend the two most vibrant forces in Western culture because these are your markets. And for some reason, he doesn't seem convinced. But I think it's interesting. I think partly they want to preserve future profits by resisting regulation. But why they've decided to go all out to stop a ban on human cloning is a very interesting question. If it weren't for the Biotechnology Industry Organization, the trade group for the biotech industry, we would have banned human cloning at a federal level and joined much of the international community in doing so. But they've stopped it.
Is human cloning science fiction or is it science fact at this point?
Well, it's science fiction, which is now fast becoming science fact, in that, so far as we know, there'd be no clone babies actually born, but already, both in South Korea and in the United Kingdom, we have had cloned embryos, cloned human embryos, which have been cloned and have been destroyed to try and get the stem cells out of them for experiments. That's already happened. It just happened in the last year. And so an embryo is an embryo. And if you can clone an embryo, you can implant the embryo. The embryo can be born as a bouncing baby. We've already crossed the Rubicon. I mean, we cloned Dolly the sheep back in the 90s. We've now begun to clone human embryos.
It sounds to me, and it has seemed to me for the last 5 years or so, that the kind of the party line of the biotech industry is, look, human cloning is bad, except it's bad if we want to create a race of clones, if we want to clone for what they would say reproductive purposes. But human cloning isn't so bad if we want to do it for quote-unquote therapeutic purposes. What kind of a distinction are they attempting to make there? And is that really a moral distinction, the one that they call the one they're trying to make?
Well, plainly at one level, it is a distinction in that it is different, you know, having an embryo and having a born baby. But cloning as a technology is one and the same thing. And what we find, a lot of people now who are arguing in favor of what they call therapeutic cloning, or cloning embryos for research, are really not being honest about this, because they say this is a different thing. It's a different thing altogether from cloning babies, but it's not. It's the same technology. You clone an embryo, and then you can implant the embryo, or you can research on the embryo, or you can, you know, leave the embryo in the fridge. I mean, it's an embryo is an embryo. And what is interesting is that around the world, I mean, other countries get it. A lot of Americans do not know at all that around the world, many other countries, which are often very liberal countries, they're not countries that have banned abortion, for example, have actually banned cloning embryos for any purpose at all.
Altogether.
You go to Canada, you know, pro-gay marriage Canada, and you clone an embryo for research, and you don't get a Nobel Prize. You get 5 years in jail. Just as an example.
So why is the American biotech industry different? I mean, normally, when it comes to life issues, we're always being told by those who say who are in favor of abortion, we need to follow the lead of these Western and Northern European countries. They are showing us the way. Why is America the exception on human cloning?
Isn't it interesting? I think partly it's because the pro-life movement is very powerful in this country, of course, not least here in the state of Missouri. And it's been easier for the biotech industry to say, well, this is just a pro-life issue. You go to Canada, there's a much weaker pro-life movement. And in Canada, the ban on cloning wasn't driven, in fact, by pro-lifers. It was driven by feminists. France, they banned human cloning. France is the most secular major country in the world. And in France, you don't get 5 years in jail for cloning embryos research. You get 7 years in jail. Germany banned all this stuff 15 years ago. The Germans know all about, you know, you don't trust scientists. The Germans remember the Nazis. The United Nations, you know, the UN General Assembly, which most conservatives hate, the UNGA voted earlier this year with the personal encouragement of President Bush, who made a speech to the GA about this a year or two ago, voted by nearly 3-1 in a declaration to call on all nations everywhere to ban all cloning. I mean, this is in the wider world, this isn't seen as the pro-life debate. And part of the trick here in Missouri, where you have a powerful pro-life movement, is to fight against cloning without simply making it a pro-life issue. Because, I mean, there are feminists, and there are environmentalists, and there are, you know, liberal pro-choice Christians who will work with us against cloning.
So maybe part of the weakness here from the pro-life side is that it gets pigeonholed not only as a pro-life concern, an exclusively pro-life concern, but perhaps even more narrowly, a religious concern. I mean, that's one of the things we often hear. If you are opposed to cloning, you must have some sort of religious reason for being opposed to cloning. It sounds like, in many places, that's not the basis for opposing cloning.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's a great question. I think it's been very convenient for those who basically do not want to regulate this technology, who want to be able to be free to do experiments and to make money in the universities or in business. I mean, very convenient for them to be able to pigeonhole this as a pro-life issue, and indeed as an issue for the extreme pro-lifers, they would say. Because, of course, there are some people who say they're pro-life, like your governor and like Senator Hatch, who are on the other side of this debate. And these people are saying, you know, well, you can still be pro-life and even be pro-cloning for research. And so it's been easy for those who are in favor of cloning to gang up and say this is really just a minority religious pro-life issue. But they got to wake up and join the world. I mean, if France votes to make something a felony, it can hardly be a pro-life religious issue. I mean, it's a joke if you want to suggest that.
Does it stop at cloning per se, or the cloning for the harvesting of stem cells? Where, as far as you can tell, Dr. Cameron, where does the biotech industry want to go with this technology, or what's the next technology they're hoping to exploit?
Well, that is a very scary question, because believe me, you know, you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, this is just the very beginning. You see, just this isn't just speculation. Look what's already happened. The biotech industry fought tooth and nail to prevent Congress banning the issuing of patents on human embryos. They wanted to be able to patent human embryos. So if your embryo was genetically engineered to deal with disease or to make some other changes, they got royalties. Now, they lost that fight in Congress. Look what's happened in New Jersey. New Jersey is the place to watch. The law in New Jersey doesn't just say you can clone embryos for research. It says you can clone embryos all the way through to term for research. It defines cloning as live birth of a cloned baby.
So anything short of the clone coming to full term and being born,
yes,
is considered fair
it's
game.
Okay, and the biotech industry endorsed that law. They testified in favor of it. And I think it plainly shows that they want to be able to experiment, you know, on cloned fetuses. Now, this is not projection, sci-fi, you know, what I think will happen 20 years' time. They have already taken these positions in New Jersey and taken them in Congress on the patenting of embryos. Plenty of what some people there want. A lot of people in biotech are good, honorable, moral people. And they're producing cures for diseases and producing medications and so on. There are some people there who are driving this debate, and they really want to be able to turn human beings into commodities to make money out of us and to blur the distinction between us and our stuff.
So how would you describe, if you could put it in a sentence or a paragraph, how would you describe, Dr. Cameron, the view of life among those in the biotech industry who have these dreams of basically commercializing a human being? How would you describe their view of life?
Well, I think the bad guys who've been driving the debate, I think their view of life is just another commodity, and they want to make money out of it. I mean, it is ironic. I mean, basically, we defeated the Soviet Union with its economic reduction of human life, the Marxist-Leninists with their notion that, you know, man is what he eats, mm-hmm. that we're just stuff. And here we have, you know, America, which has the strongest religious community in the world, as well as three-quarters of the world biotech industry. Here we have America basically bringing to birth the notion that the economic reduction of human nature, just stuff, through this vision of human beings. I think it's crazy, and ironically, it's also very, very bad for business. Because if you want to make money in the biotech industry, it seems to me you should be yelling and screaming to tell them to leave human nature alone. Otherwise, they're not going to have any markets. And I think, finally, that may be what brings them back to reality.
We're talking about the sanctity of life, what there is of it in the biotech industry. Dr. Nigel Cameron is our guest. You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Friday, a rare live Friday broadcast of Issues Etc. from the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis at the Westport Lakeside Chalet. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to give us a call if you have a question for Dr. Cameron on the sanctity of life and the biotech industry. Is there any other industry parallel to the biotech industry that has the luxury at this point of being largely unregulated the way the biotech industry is? And, of course, the biotech industry is pushing for continuation of that lack of regulation on what they do. Any other industry that has that luxury?
Well, I think this is partly a problem with new technologies, in that plainly you have FDA regulations and EPA and so on, and you get technologies coming along that raise questions that weren't being addressed before because they can do new things. And the real parallel is in nanotechnology, which is this technology focused on manipulation of very tiny, tiny amounts of matter, and creating ultimately tiny, tiny machines and products. And nanotechnology is raising some similar questions. But I'm delighted, for example, that the nanotechnology industry seems to be much more interested in having these ethical discussions and behaving in a way that is morally appropriate than the people in biotech, or certain people driving the biotech debate.
One of the things that concerns me is that the rhetoric of the biotech industry, those who are calling for and using kind of the false distinction between therapeutic and reproductive cloning, that rhetoric is being picked up, believed, and repeated by many of our lawmakers who seem very comfortable with the idea of cloning a human being and harvesting stem cells from a human embryo for the purposes of seeking cures to diseases, and then at the same time would shrink in horror from the idea of cloning a human being to bring them to full term. And they seem to have bought into the whole distinction that the biotech industry is putting forward. What would you say to lawmakers if you had the opportunity to do so? What would you say to them? A quick cloning 101 or biotech 101 to set the record straight on what they should be supporting and what they shouldn't be supporting?
Sure. Well, I'd say, first of all, don't be convinced by the notion this is just crazy pro-lifers. There are plenty of non-pro-lifers, non-crazy, crazy liberals, crazy progressives, you know, around the world and in the U.S., who are also in favor of man and cloning. I mean, it's just dishonest to say it's just people like some of us. Secondly, what's good for business is building public confidence in business and the moral values on which business is being conducted. The notion that you will make a killing by offending vast numbers of Americans on this technology is crazy. Thirdly, what we need to do is to recognize that mass-producing human embryos... I mean, okay, maybe we can agree to disagree about what you do with the spare embryos for stem cells. I mean, in that area, you know, we take a certain view. People take another view in conscience, and we can have that as a separate conversation. But mass-producing human embryos... I mean, people have calculated, if this therapeutic cloning idea were ever to work, the notion you can make one-on-one medications for people by basically cloning twins for them, which is how it would work... that this is the powerful idea out there that many people have been taken in by. There's no evidence it's going to work. But if that were to work, it would involve mass-producing billions of human embryos.
Now, how do you do that? Because as far as I know, at least at this point, you still need an ovum, an egg, at the beginning of every single one of these human cloned human embryos. Where do you get the eggs?
This is a great question. You get them from, quote, donors, unquote, and the donors will be poor women, poor American women, poor women from around the world. And this is a major reason why many feminists who are totally opposed to our position on abortion will work hand-in-hand with us on this issue, because they can see this as a way to exploit women. Very interesting. If you follow what's happening in California, Prop 71, the big debate there, and I hope every lawmaker in the state of Missouri, you know, spends a weekend catching up on what's really been happening in California under 71, where, you know, some of us predicted, once it went through, the press turned on the whole thing, and a lot of the conscientious left turned on the whole thing. And Senator Deborah Ortiz, who was the leading booster for 71 in the California legislature, has been asking some very serious questions now, because she sees California's women being exploited. She sees all the money tracking back into biotech companies and universities, not going to the people of California. The whole thing is a shambles. And if you see what's happened there, you begin to realize that ultimately poor people will bear the brunt of this technology. And as you say, you've got to get eggs. Now, you can produce sperm in large quantities very cheaply. Getting eggs is risky in healthcare terms. I mean, people have died having their superovulating and having eggs taken out. And it'll be poor women who do it.
Even then, I mean, even if, say, the technology existed to do it in some sort of efficient, cost-effective manner that wouldn't, say, risk the lives of poor women... Does the math?
You mean like magic?
Well, yes, like magic. Does the math still work out? There are only, let's say, for a conservative estimate, 3 billion women in the world, and if you're talking about billions and billions of cloned human embryos, you have to have a lot of women involved in this.
You bet. But of course, this partly draws attention to that. Even if it just did work, if this therapeutic cloning thing were to work, what it would mean would be very expensive cures for a few wealthy people. And there are various reasons why people who are, if you like, on the left of the political spectrum should be very unhappy with this, which is what's happening in California now. I mean, the whole thing is falling apart there because people are realizing that a lot of people voted through 71 because it was anti-George W. Bush. They didn't like him. They did not like the pro-lifers. They didn't like the influence from the government. That's why they voted it through. They now realize that they were basically taken to the cleaners. I had an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle just before the vote with my friend Jennifer Law, and what we said was, if you made these claims for therapeutic cloning in an IPO rather than in a proposition on a ballot, you go to jail. You make them on a ballot proposition, you get away with it, and California is now $6 billion the poorer, and basically this is not going to work, and if it did work, it would involve exploiting all the poor women in California. Now, Missouri does not want to go that way.
So... it sounds as though the economic force of gravity here is going to be one of the biggest obstacles the bioethics industry will have to overcome, if they can overcome it at all, to have their way with the future of their industry.
Well, they want public money to support highly speculative science and development, things that private investors will not invest in. Venture capitalists are walking away from this. I mean, all the numbers there are very, very plain. They want public money to support highly speculative investment. The universities, of course, want public money. I mean, huge amounts of public money. That's how they employ scientists. And all the risk is on the shoulder for the public, and they stand to gain any benefits that will come. Even if there aren't any benefits, you know, the public money will keep them going for a few years. So they have a huge economic interest, basically, in taking taxpayers' money to support research that will probably go nowhere. If the research were even 10% as promising as they say it is, in these often quite dishonest statements they make about how wonderful it is, the private investors will be pouring in more money than they could use. But they aren't doing that. And, of course, this is because they don't believe a word of it. The market's valuation on cloning for stem cell research is somewhere around zero.
So the goal here, really, of those who want to expose the view of life in the biotech industry is to simply run the numbers, show people what this really means, and hope to have happen in the public sector what people have already realized in the private sector. This doesn't even make economic sense.
That's part of what we have to do, and in parallel with that, what we have to do is to say, don't you brand this as just another pro-life issue. We can have our fights on abortion another day. Here we can work with feminists and with environmentalists. We can work with the Canadians and the French and the Germans and the Australians. We can work with three-quarters of the United Nations to ban this technology, and people who do therapeutic cloning should go to jail. They shouldn't be subsidized by the fund, by public funding to do it.
So then with that all said and with only 30 seconds, Dr. Cameron, how hopeful are you that that argument will stick? And how hopeful are you that we will be able to do what so many other countries on the planet have been able to do and see the danger of what the biotech industry is proposing for the future?
Well, I hope the people of Missouri are certainly as clever and as skeptical as the people of Canada, France, Germany, Australia, Switzerland, home of the banks, you know, and home of the European pharmaceutical industry. They've all banned this stuff. The people of Missouri need to ban it too and need not to believe the lies they're being told.
Dr. Nigel Cameron is president of the Institute on Biotechnology and the Human Future. He's director of the Council for Biotechnology Policy. He delivered a keynote address here at the Image of God Bioethics Conference in St. Louis titled The Sanctity of Life in the Biotech Industry. Dr. Cameron, it's a pleasure. Very nice to meet you. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
When we come back from this break, the second half hour of Issues, Etc., we'll be spending with Wesley Smith, a regular guest. Now, up until this point, Wesley has been a phone guest with us, usually joining us from the fair West Coast. Well, in just a few minutes, he'll join us here on the floor of the conference of the Image of God Bioethics Conference. We'll be talking with him about bioethics and personhood coming up in just a few minutes. Feel free to join us. You have questions or comments for Wesley Smith in the next half hour as we talk about bioethics and personhood. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And we're coming to you live, a rare live Friday Issues, Etc., from the floor of the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Coming up next time on The Bible Study, we will conclude our study of the book of Nahum as we take on Chapter 3 with Pastor Ron Rall of Timothy Lutheran Church in St. Louis. Don't forget about Wednesday, a live Bible study broadcast from Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville. We'll be in Hebrews 2 for that. Listen to The Bible Study weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Dining with sinners. That's what happens every Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The Lord Jesus himself comes and spreads his banquet table before us, sinners, not a target group of professionals, but sinners in need of the one thing that only he can give, the forgiveness that he won for us at the cross. Christian, seeker, unbeliever, it doesn't matter. All those who are burdened by their sin and hungry for God's forgiveness are invited to visit Bethany Lutheran Church, 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights.
While choosing the right medical plan and a good doctor is high on most Americans' priority list, for one global minute, prayerfully consider the plight of Burmese people living in Myanmar. Doctors of any kind are rare in Myanmar, and there are no health care provisions for the poor. Now that's why many elderly flock across the Thai border seeking treatment. Myanmar spends millions for the latest weapons, but its people are starving and dying of disease. Only the rich can get the food and medical care they need. But the Burmese don't realize they also suffer from a different kind of sickness, one that can't be medically treated at a Thai clinic. The only cure for the heart sickness called sin is receiving Jesus Christ as Lord, and few Burmese have heard the gospel. Pray God will reopen this country closed to the gospel of the great physician, Jesus Christ. Find encouragement to pray for the unreached. Come and visit missionvisionnetwork.org.
The Meyer Minute is underwritten by the North St. Louis County Chapter of Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, including Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church on Benham Road and Grace Chapel Lutheran Church on Lance Drive.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The United States Christian Commission was formed in 1861 to help the temporal and spiritual well-being of military personnel. A group commemorating the United States Christian Commission shares this story. In the Battle of Gettysburg, Chaplain Eastman's horse fell on him, wounding his leg, making it impossible for the chaplain to stand and walk. As he lay suffering, he heard a voice, "Oh, my God! Can anybody be swearing in such a place as this?" He listened again, and a prayer began. It was from a wounded soldier. "How can I get at him?" He tried to draw up his stiffened limb, but he could not rise. He then thought, "I can roll." And over he rolled, in pain and blood, and by dead bodies, until he fell against the dying man, and there he preached Christ and prayed. At length, one of the line officers came up and said, "Where's the chaplain?" "One of the staff officers is dying." Here he is," cried out the sufferer. "Can you come and see a dying officer?" "I cannot move. I had to roll myself to this dying man to talk to him." "If I detail two men to carry you, then can you go?" The chaplain answered, "Yes." To our chaplains, and to all who have served in the military, to you, our veterans, we are deeply indebted.
You know, there are some people who only want to be told what they want to hear. There are other people who only want to be told what they need to hear. And then there are people who want to be told what they need to hear, not because we think they need it, but because they think they need it. You know, there really is something to be said for the truth. AM 850 KFUO Radio, serving you and the rest of the world.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Wesley Smith joins us here for the next 25 minutes. We're broadcasting live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis. Now, this affords us the opportunity to be able to talk face-to-face with a number of people that we don't normally get to see face-to-face. Usually it's the distance of a phone line. Wesley Smith is one of those. We'll be talking with him about bioethics and personhood for the next 25 minutes. Then, in the second hour of the program, Dr. David Prentice, one of the presenters here at the Image of God Bioethics Conference, will join us to talk about national pro-life legislation. He made a presentation here, led a workshop this afternoon on genetic manipulation of human beings. A little later in the program, Dr. Paul Robbie will join us. We'll discuss the Image of God. He's chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Until then, Wesley Smith is our guest. He's a regular guest on the program, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, author of numerous books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. And he will deliver a keynote address tonight at the Image of God Bioethics Conference titled Bioethics Creating a Caste of Disposable People. Wesley, welcome to Issues Etc.
Todd, we meet at last.
It's so nice to see you face to face.
Wow, this is pretty cool. I thought you had more hair.
No, that's what everyone thinks. They always say, "I thought you were older," and I'm older than I look, and they always say, "I thought you had more hair." Actually, I'm growing it out a little bit, Wesley. I am. This is
really?
Yeah, this is longer than it usually is. This is actually shaggy for me, but I'll take care of that.
I'll take care of that forthwith. I'll just go home and run the razor over my head, and that'll all be taken care of.
Then you can look really hip, see?
Well, that's my goal. That's my goal. You cross the 40-year mark, and you have to spend your time trying to look hip.
When are you getting to your 50s?
Well, okay, what is this concept of personhood? It sounds so metaphysical. It sounds so philosophical. But it strikes me from the many conversations that we have had that this idea stands at the center of so many of the ethical dilemmas that are presented to us every day in the realm of bioethics.
I think it is perhaps the most important question of the 21st century. We have a situation facing us now where we have the question before the House is, does human life have intrinsic value simply and merely because it's human? Or to put it another way, does human life matter? If you believe in the sanctity of life ethic or the equality of life ethic, you're going to say, yes, being human in and of itself brings value. And there are certain things because of that value that we will not do to human lives. For example, we will not treat any human life as an object. All human lives are subjects. If you answer no to that question, which many in bioethics are, many in the animal liberation movement, for example, are, many materialist Darwinists are, then you have to say, well, then what is it, if it's not being human, that gives ultimate value, what does? And in bioethics, increasingly, and certainly not every bioethicist, but certainly the mainstream view, it is being a person. A person is an entity or an organism that has sufficient cognitive capacity or mental abilities. For example, being self-aware over time or being able to value your life. That gives personhood, which gives what you and I would call human rights. So in personhood theory, not all human beings are persons, and one does not have to necessarily be a human to be a person. For example, many believe that some animals, particularly the higher primates and elephants, are persons. Some are even talking about someday having a computer that has become intelligent can be considered a person and therefore would have the right to life, for example. In the human sphere, all unborn lives, according to this theory, are not persons. Neither are newborn babies. That's why you see Peter Singer, who's the bioethicist at Princeton, saying that parents should have 1 year within which to keep or kill their newborns. Not because they're disabled, even though he uses a disabled baby in his illustrations. That's not what makes these babies killable in his view. It is because they are not persons. Terry Schiavo, during the dehydration death of Terry Schiavo, I had a national debate. And I asked a bioethicist, do you think Terry Schiavo is a person? And he said, no, she's not, because she didn't have these cognitive capacities. And I said, does that mean that she should have been able to be taken for her organs? Yes, she should have, because she no longer, when you lose personhood, you lose bodily integrity. So you can see with the cloning debates where Dr. Cameron was just speaking, why not do cloned fetal farming? Why not create cloned embryos, put them in an artificial womb, gestate them until the point where their kidneys have developed, and then kill them and take the kidneys to be transplanted? If they're not persons, what difference does it make? If they're human, and we acknowledge that humanity, it makes a huge difference, because you do not treat a human life as a commodity to be harvested. If what matters is, quote, personhood, and you don't have sufficient quality of life to achieve that in, then you've done nothing wrong. So you can see the potential implications, especially for the most weak and vulnerable among us, such as Terry Schiavo, or elderly people, people with Alzheimer's disease, newborn infants, but particularly disabled infants, could not be more important.
So how should we reject the concept of personhood
Absolutely.
Altogether?
Well, we should reject it as a measure of moral value, in my view, especially when you're dealing with human life. What gives value is being human. That's an objective standard. You don't have to then figure out, well, if it's not being human, then what is it? Because then it becomes an issue of political power. Who has the power to decide? You know, when we said we hold these truths, Jefferson wrote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That was one of the most profound sentences in the history of the human race. It is a forceful statement of the idea of the sanctity, equality of human life. And the world, since those words, that sentence was uttered or written, has been trying to achieve that end. We have not achieved it. We had to bring African Americans into that category of protectable life, women and so forth. But now in bioethics, we're saying, well, of course, race shouldn't matter, and we all agree with that, but cognitive capacity should. But this is the same kind of bigotry, just different victims. These victims are going to be the most helpless among us, and they are going to be people who are going to be, once again, as in human slavery, treated as natural resources, as commodities to be exploited. And it is profoundly immoral, in my view, and unethical to write any human being out of a protectable class, at least in terms of not being used as an object. At the very least, I don't care what stage of human life it is, they should not be harvested, they should not be exploited, they should not be made for the purpose of being destroyed.
So to kind of come at it from a different direction, would you say that the concept of humanity and the concept of personhood should be entirely coterminous, entirely identical? That when we say human, we mean person. When we say person, we mean human, if we can salvage the term personhood at all.
Well, personhood can be a useful term. For example, a corporation is deemed an artificial person.
Okay.
But what I am saying, and that means that the corporation has rights under law, but what I am saying is that we should not measure the quality of any human life to determine whether it has rights, at least in terms of being as an object or as opposed to a subject, or a subject as opposed to an object. That we should, if one is biologically a human organism, whatever that should present in and of itself a certain status, a certain line which is not crossed, beyond which, if you cross these lines and start exploiting them as things, then you have dehumanized these people. And the reason, by the way, they're using personhood as opposed to humanhood is because bioethicists think of themselves as profoundly rational. And these organisms, if they're unborn, or these human-born organisms or persons, I mean beings, human beings, I mean that term has now been completely confused. Is mm-hmm. a human being any human organism, or is it just a born human organism? But because these bioethicists think of themselves as highly rational, they have to say, well, we can't say they're not human because they are. So we're saying that being human doesn't matter. What matters is this personhood idea.
So it's a sliding scale, a continuum, that there are people who are human, according to this personhood theory. There are humans who are not persons.
Right.
Then there are humans who are persons.
Right.
And there may be non-humans who are persons.
Right, right.
And someone, everyone, falls along that continuum someplace, depending on what characteristics
they have at this particular moment. And it means that every night you go to bed, you're going to have to earn your rights the next day. Because what if you have a stroke in the night and you lose some capacities? And you lose enough capacity so that those in power think you no longer have value. So you get Alzheimer's, like my uncle. My uncle Bruno has Alzheimer's. And he is in an advanced state. The bioethicists who support personhood theory would say my uncle is no longer a person. Well, not on my watch. My uncle, when I was 4, I remember, used to pick me up and throw me around and pretend to throw me off a slope and laugh, and I'd be laughing and giggling and his hair would be flying. Now he's a very elderly man, 90, who's lost his cognitive capacity. He's still my uncle. And I'm going to love him, and he is no less important and no less equal than he was when he was a teamster and he was supporting a family and raising his daughter.
So how would you argue, then, to take your uncle as an example, how would you argue against the sliding scale of personhood theory?
It's bigotry. It is bigotry to say that any human life has to earn their rights. It is a way to, once again, find a way to create a them and an us. It is a way, once again, to find some way to make somebody less valuable than us for the purpose of exploiting them for our benefit and our use. For the history of the human race, we've done it based on tribe, we've done it based on race, we've done it based on other various forms of so-called the eugenics movement, the fit versus the unfit, where we decided that some humans had less value than other humans and therefore we could involuntarily sterilize them, which was to use them as an object. And that kind of eugenics bigotry led directly to social Darwinism and the Holocaust. This is the same kind of bigotry, different victims. And we should say no, unequivocally, At some point, there are certain things you cannot do to any human life, and particularly you cannot treat them as a thing, as a commodity to be used and exploited for the purpose of others. Because if you can say there's a distinction to be made between the human person and the human non-person, then why can't you have distinctions among human persons? Mm. So that the person who is smarter becomes a super citizen, for example.
Right, if it's a sliding scale, then people who qualify for a higher position on the scale are more person than...
Right.
Than, so let's say, for instance, I'm a smart guy. But there's someone who's smarter.
Right. And so
does
he's
more of a person.
So he has greater value than you. And you hear some of this already being discussed in some bioethics circles. For example, there's a transhumanist, Dr. Cameron talked in his talk about transhumanism, which seeks to create a post-human species. This is a whole social movement, and we've discussed it on your show before. There's a fellow named James Hughes who wrote a book called Citizen Cyborg, in which he's talking about the basis of transhumanism is this personhood theory. He and I agree on the issue of the 21st century. He and I have had communication. We've had online debates. I reviewed his book. He reviewed my book. We agree that the issue for the 21st century is, does human life give value or does personal life, being a person, give value? And in his book, Citizen Cyborg, he says there's such a thing as a person. Then he calls it a mature person. So then he begins, and these would be the enhanced forms of life.
The next generation.
Yes. And so, you know, maybe then those of us who are the unenhanced, suddenly we're become, as some bioethicists have said, you know, we'll do the menial work. You know, we won't be able to advance as far. This is eugenics. Come back again. It is distinguishing, deciding what human traits are better than other human traits, which is supremely hubristic and dangerous. And it is bigotry. And what strikes me, stuns me continually, is the people who claim to care so much about human equality and doing away with discrimination embrace this other form of discrimination. It's almost like they're blind to the idea that that by excluding the most weak and vulnerable among us, you have ceased to be a liberal society. We're pushing people out of the lifeboat with this idea. And it is dangerous because none of us is safe if every day we wake up, we have to earn our status as protectable and protected people with rights.
We're coming to you live this Friday, November the 11th, broadcasting live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference here at the Westport Lakeside Chalet in St. Louis. Wesley Smith is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Our phone numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In about 10 minutes, we're going to be joined by, who are we going to be going next? Dr. David Prentice will join us for the second hour of the program. We'll talk about national pro-life legislation as we continue to broadcast from the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis. Wesley, I think popularly, for some reason, this idea of personhood appeals to people. But if pressed on issues, you mentioned before Terry Schiavo, someone who consistently holds this personhood theory, says she's not a person. Therefore, yes, she is fair game. Her organs are fair game for harvesting. Most people will say, now, wait a minute.
Right.
I kind of like the personhood thing. You know, maybe that appeals to me because it's hard for me to imagine, say, a person in a nursing home who's lost all their capacities is really a person like I am, but not harvesting their organs.
Because, you know, there is an understanding in our guts. Leon Cass, the head of the President's Council on Bioethics, calls it the wisdom of repugnance. You know, we don't eat each other. That is repugnant. There's a reason that's repugnant. And that doesn't necessarily win the debate, but when we get that understanding, well, there's something really worth checking out here. Let's talk about human cloning, therapeutic cloning. Here in Missouri, they want to create a constitutional amendment to engage in human cloning and maintain those human cloned embryos through the 14th day and use them in medical research and then require that they be destroyed. Now, this is requiring that human life be destroyed, not permitting it, but requiring it. They will say, when you press them and say, well, how can you do that to human life? They'll say, well, they don't look human. Well, yes, they do. That's what humans look like at that stage. They don't have arms and legs. Well, that's not a scientific issue. That's appealing to a certain common emotion. And they will say they're not cognitive. They don't have sentience. And that's absolutely true. A 14-day embryo does not have a brain. It doesn't have a neural system. They'll say it's not a person. And I'll say, well, then neither is Terry Schiavo. Neither is my Uncle Bruno under those theories, because you are creating an artificial distinction based on subjective criteria that you are deciding because you have the power to decide. In a personhood world, you can have babies, anencephalic babies born for purposes of harvesting. You could actually engineer them to only have a brain stem until they're born, so that you could use those body tissues. You could do that through cloning and through genetic manipulations.
And on the sliding scale, you can say, since they never had a higher brain, they could never possess, they never will possess, all of the characteristics
right.
that we think attach personhood to someone.
Right.
Therefore,
they're usable for whatever purpose we wish. That is the logical outcome of personhood theory. In believing in the sanctity, equality of human life, ethic, you say, look, you do not do that to human life, not only because of it's wrong to do it to that human organism or that human being, but what does it say and how does it affect our attitudes towards the rest of human life, the rest of the human community? When you say that one aspect of the human community or certain portions of that community can be excluded, can be put outside the gate, then you are basically saying that human life has not intrinsic value, and therefore each of us has only those rights which those in power permit us to have. And it is an anti-liberal approach. Liberalism is about protecting the weakest and most vulnerable among us. This is a eugenic self-I-I-me-me approach that says, I can use those weaker lives to benefit myself or to benefit my Uncle Charlie. And yet, we have, for example, with adult stem cell research, no moral problems at all. And as Dr. Cameron spoke about, tremendous achievements already being achieved. We don't have to choose between morality and alleviating suffering. We aren't being given that hard, difficult option. We actually have the ability to have our cake and eat it too.
In the last few minutes here, Wesley, return to this idea that you only glanced past momentarily at the beginning of our conversation, the whole idea of animal rights, and how does it play into this sliding scale of personhood theory?
Oh, that's very interesting. You've got two aspects of this, actually three. Bioethicists and animal liberationists will say this. If you say that human life has intrinsic value simply and merely because it is human, you are being speciesist. That is, you are discriminating against animals, which is deemed to be something akin to racism, which, by the way, to me is a deeply misanthropic view. It is anti-human to compare animals and humans. And the bioethicists will say some humans, you know, that if a dog has higher mental capacities than Terry Schiavo, then that dog actually has higher moral value. And therefore, if you're going to use that dog, for example, in medical research, you also have to be willing to use Terry Schiavo because she has lower value based on her capacities. In the animal liberation movement, which is a profoundly anti-human movement, I'm not talking about animal welfare, SPCA, mm-hmm. which we all support, helping to improve the way we treat cattle and that kind of thing. But animal liberation says it isn't being human that gives value, it is the ability to feel pain. So if you can feel pain, you are equal. Therefore, Ingrid Newkirk, who's the head of the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, says a rat is a dog, is a pig, is a boy, and she means it literally. A lot of people wonder, how come these animal liberationists are becoming violent? How come they're attacking research scientists who are trying to come up with medical cures? Because they literally believe that doing animal research is the same thing as Mangala in the camps. It's hard to get your mind around, but they literally believe it. They believe that the cattle cars taking the cattle to the feedlot is the same thing as the train taking Jews to Auschwitz.
But it's not and you pointed this out before, Wesley, it's not simply, they would say, well, all we're trying to do is elevate people's view of the lesser species, if they'd even say that. But we're trying to elevate their view so that we treat them more humanely.
No, they're not. That's the animal welfare movement, and often animal liberation, animal rights will hide behind animal welfare. What animal liberation, animal rights is saying is humans have no right to use animals in any fashion whatsoever. Indeed, people like Gary Francione, who's a professor at Rutgers University, has set up a law clinic where he wants animals to be able to become litigants. he would say and has said to me in private conversation and in public debate, we have no right to have any domestic animals at all.
Even pets.
Even pets, mm-hmm. and even seeing eye dogs, because to cause, to have, it's akin to slavery, and it is by definition to cause them suffering. He wants to see all existing domestic animals treated humanely for as long as they live, and no new ones created. No new dogs, no new cats, no new cows, and then they'll just be animals in the wild, and they have the right to their freedom, just as we have the right to our freedom. This is a very radical anti-human movement. It equates humans and animals in terms of moral value, and it would cause tremendous human harm, because we wouldn't be able to use animals in medical research, for example. And you wouldn't be able to have seeing eye dogs.
We might well be using human beings in medical
research. Peter Singer has said, when asked by Psychology Today, well, didn't we have to use chimpanzees to create the hepatitis vaccines? He said, well, we should probably, instead of using chimps, should have used people in a comas instead, because they have lower value, because they have lower capacities than chimps.
Wesley, with only about 30 seconds here, you used the term several times throughout our conversation, ultimate value.
Right.
In response to those who would assign ultimate value, really no ultimate value to human beings, only contingent value, tentative value to human beings, make the argument, if you would, 30 seconds, for the ultimate value of every human being.
Well, we can just make it on a consequentialist term. If every human being doesn't have equal moral value, then every human being is subject to oppression, exploitation, and killing based on falling beneath those criteria that are set by the powers that be to have value. If we don't all have ultimate value, there's no such thing as human rights. As you put it, all our rights are contingent, and all our rights are subject to being canceled based on our current health status or mental status on any given day.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, very proud to say a regular guest here on Issues Etc., an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, author of numerous books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and he will be delivering tonight the keynote address at the Image of God Bioethics Conference, titled Bioethics Creating a Cast of Disposable People. Wesley, great to see you face-to-face, and it's great to have you on the program.
Great to see you, Todd, and hello to Jeff, your producer, who is always so kind to me behind the scenes.
He is a kind guy. Catch him at the right moment. Thanks for being our guest.
All right, thanks, Todd.
Well, when we come back for Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., Dr. David Prentice is going to join us here on the floor of the conference, the Image of God Bioethics Conference. We're going to be talking about national pro-life legislation. He's a senior fellow for the Life Sciences for the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C., an adjunct professor of medical and molecular genetics for Indiana University. Stay tuned for the second hour of Issues, Etc., broadcasting live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.